Do you think you wrote a better book than the last time?
The thing is...
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes, which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Marcus Suzak is the author of several books, but he's probably best known for The Book Thief, which has sold 16 million copies worldwide, is published in 42 foreign language territories, and has spent over 500 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. It's been 13 years since The Book Thief was published, and now Suzak has a new book that he thinks is even better. Bridge of Clay is a sweeping family saga about five boys who raise each other, in a way, after their mother's death and their father's disappearance. I spoke with Marcus Suzak just prior to the book's release about this book and its history. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Now, Bridge of Clay is your third book, and you're probably best known for your second book, The Book Thief. I've seen a lot of chatter out there in the ether about, you know, the 13-year stretch between books. But, you know, what was the timeline for Bridge of Clay? I mean, how much time did you spend on it compared to I Am the Messenger or The Book Thief?
Yeah, well, actually, the timeline for all books is always... There are always several answers to that kind of question, because you could calculate it from the time you actually started writing or from the time you got the idea. And I actually got the idea for this book when I was 19 or 20 years old. So it's actually been in me for a few decades. I started writing around 2000, and towards the end of 2005, I started having my first goes at it. But then you spend a lot of time scratching around, searching, and you'll write something and you'll say, you look at it and you go, well, that's not it. So you try something else and you say, oh, well, that's not it either. And then I think it takes a while, sometimes more than a year, to even get a beginning that you're happy with. So I did spend a long time writing this book, and I spent a lot of time failing in the first, you know, couple of years. And then it's amazing how long a couple of years can stretch. You turn around and then a decade's gone. But I think in that time, you also don't realize how much work you've actually gotten done. And so by about 2016, you know, when 10 years had passed and I thought I'd failed completely and that I had to put the book aside, I realized that I was really three quarters of the way through. And I just had to get my hands a little dirtier to finish the job altogether.
You know, it didn't strike me as being that long of a time period. I mean, your answer is very typical of what I hear from a lot of authors. And maybe it's just because fans were waiting or were waiting for the next one. Maybe that's where the whole, oh my gosh, it's been 13 years is coming from, because it just didn't seem that improbable to me.
So. Yeah, it's one of those things where, I mean, there are some authors who put a book out every year. I know some authors who put two books out a year, and but then you have the author who does take a decade to write a book, and it's looking more like that's the way I seem to be heading. And but I think it was one of those things where it didn't feel so long in some ways, because the previous book, you know, because The Book Thief just always sort of seemed to be hanging around, and just when I thought, oh well, that's the end of The Book Thief, something else would happen. And it would sort of reappear. And so in a lot of ways that makes things easier, but then in others it makes it a little harder, because you're still constantly talking about that book. And, you know, and that's what you hope for in your career, is to have a book that does sort of go the distance. And so for that reason, you know, the pressure's both off and on. And you, as a writer, you feel like, you know, like any job, you want to finish things, but you want to finish them the way they should be finished. And sometimes that takes longer.
You know, the story, this Bridge of Clay, it's been described as a family saga, but it felt like a contemporary family saga. So many of the movies or the TV shows mentioned were moments I remembered vividly from the 80s. And yeah. The family is the Dunbars, and the parents are Penelope and Michael, and the boys are Matthew, Rory, Henry, Clay, and Tommy. Did I get those right?
Yeah,
you okay. Did. And they are a rough and tumble bunch with their own set of rules, and the narrator is the oldest son, Matthew, and he's writing He's writing the story on a Remington typewriter that he dug up from the backyard of his father's childhood home, along with the skeleton of a dog and a snake. So I mean, I have a Remington typewriter. I collect typewriters. Have you ever written on a typewriter? How do you write?
I have. and of course, it comes with its own set of challenges. And, you know, it's funny, that whole idea. So when I was 6 years into the book, I decided that I was going to need to make a change, or I had a narrator of the book outside the family, and a girl called Maggie. And then I changed to Matthew being the narrator. And the beginning was never exactly like that. There was no digging up of a typewriter or anything like that at all. It was someone sitting on a roof waiting for someone to come home. And but then I was having all these problems with the book. It just felt very distant all the time. And then I thought, let's move this and let's have the narrator be sitting in the kitchen. And then that idea came to me because I knew that there was a dog and a snake buried in the ground there. And I thought, oh, what if he goes out and unearths this typewriter? And that's what he's writing the story on. And I think there was something that really excited me about that idea. There isn't necessarily anything quirky in the voice of Matthew, but just that idea of, you know, it's almost like he's digging up the past and he sits down in the kitchen and he writes on that typewriter. And it felt alive when I was writing that. And I think that's what you're always looking for when you're writing a book, is you're asking yourself, is this alive or is it dead? And if it's dead, you got to try to bring it to life in a hurry, or you might have to cut that, whatever that piece isn't working. And so it's always this riddle that you're always trying to get to make the book be exactly what it needs to be. And the typewriter felt a part of that. But yeah, I've still got a typewriter, but you know, the ribbon's all shot to bits. You know, so you allow yourself certain things in a novel to sort of say, all right, he's dug this up, let's let him use it, and you run with it sometimes.
Well, and there was one point in the story where Matthew veered away from telling Clay's story to tell a bit of his own, and it was when he was ridiculed in sixth grade for taking piano lessons. And although I can't say exactly what Jimmy Hartwell said to Matthew, the word he used was said emphatically, and Matthew remarked that kid was made for italics, which made me smile. And then at first I thought, well, wait a second, this was typed on a typewriter. How would he use italics? But then I remembered back from, I mean, I grew up with typewriters, writing term papers on a typewriter before word processors and computers came about, and there was always a way to designate on a typewriter. You know, a typewritten piece when words were set to be in italics, and they were underlined.
It's funny, I know. It was one of the questions I did ask myself as I was writing the book, where I went, oh, italics, and then I remember seeing stories, you know, that were written a long time ago on typewriters that were published with italics, and I thought, I think I'm just going to give Matthew some leeway on that one.
I'm glad you did. I loved that line. It just triggered something, though. But, you know, that would only be for people of a certain age who would even think that.
And I think it's all in the delivery. You know, I think you're taking a really nice viewpoint of that, but someone could be quite cranky and say, oh, well, that would never have happened. you couldn't have done that. But I think in that sense, you're making a few leaps every now and again, and hope people will leap with you.
You know, very much a part of the family was this menagerie of pets in the household, and they were, for the most part, adopted by Tommy and named by him. He was the youngest child. Mm-hmm. What were the pets, and what were they named after? Who were they named after?
All right, so the family does have a mule named Achilles, a cat called Hector, a border collie called Rosie, a goldfish called Agamemnon, and a pigeon called Telemachus, or shortened to T, is what the other brothers shorten it to, because they, as is said in the book, you know, God, how we hated Tommy for those names. and it's Tommy's only. There was a line in the book that, and I ended up changing it. You know, you make changes all the way through, because sometimes you've got to make decisions that are not necessarily best for a character, but best for the book. And it's just the original line was that Tommy named the animals that way because he knew their mother less than the rest of the boys did, or had less time with her. And so he named them after the books that she loved and read to them, which were the Iliad and the Odyssey. And that's the theme that runs all the way through the book. And so, you know, and I just love the idea of a mule named Achilles. And that's why they live in a racing quarter of the city they live in. I was always running this sort of fine line between, you know, making something exceptional happen, but then getting people to believe it. And a lot of times there are companion animals to race horses, you know, whether it's a mule or a goat or a Shetland pony in some cases. That's really the whole reason the book was set in a racing section of Sydney where I grew up, was, you know, so that the mule would have its place in the book, and the names were also important.
And were the settings that you mentioned, were they all real?
Well, it's interesting. I basically made a fictitious racing quarter in Sydney based on the sort of places that I already knew of and that I researched. And I never name Sydney as the city, but
right.
People who know the city will recognise certain place names. And that's because, you know, they say in writing that to make something universal, you make it very specific and local. But I don't necessarily always believe that. I just wanted it to be a city, and I wanted it to be your city when you read it. And only, you know, there's a certain point where you can recognise it as an exact city like Sydney. And, you know, and that's with references to things like the Opera House and place names like Circular Quay and things like that. So in a lot of ways, as it is with most fiction, I think, you know, you sort of mash up the real and the imagined, and what you end up with is a place all of its own, and that's the world of your book.
And I had, I looked up, like, the name of the river. I couldn't come up with anything, so
yeah.
It just made me wonder exactly how much was in your own imagination.
Yeah, well, the Amanu River is named that way for a specific reason. And even Clay, or Matthew, actually says, you know, the river had a strange name. Because it's almost like it sounds more kind of Polynesian or something like that, Amanu. And,
mm-hmm.
But it's actually, you know, if you mix the letters up, if you change the letters around, it can be easily changed to a human. You know, so I just wanted it to be, you know, it's almost a character in the novel itself. And there's pretty much a specific reason for all the names in the book. All the street names are named after famous Australian racehorses of the past. So you're just always looking, or not even looking, but I think you always stumble across things that add just bit by bit to the world of the story and give it its own personality.
Now, you know, all of your books are categorized as books for young readers, but they are also beloved by adults. Do you have a specific audience in mind when you write?
Not usually, and I think the book should always dictate that. And in this case, I just wanted to, you know, every time you just want to write a better book than you did the last time. And I could see, I think what's happened is that over the years, my books have become different, you know, and I think I like the idea that you grow with every book and that you're not trying to write the same book as last time. And so this book to me in tone always felt older, even though we're starting with a 16-year-old protagonist. This book to me was just always fiction. And to me, those sort of categories never matter. I just think of the books that I love, and they're on a shelf at the top of my bookshelf all on their own, and that's the kind of book I'm trying to write. Once a book is loved, it transcends the category that it comes from. And so, you know, if you fall short, no, and someone doesn't love your book well, or it's not their favourite book, there's no shame in that. There are a lot of great books in the world, but you have to try. And that's what I'm trying to do every time I sit down and work.
Do you think you wrote a better book than the last time?
The thing is, it's I'd also have people say, you don't have to write a better book. You just have to write a different book. And I'd say, no, I have to write a better book. And in this case, I know because I did the audio version of the book as well. And the one thing that I can say is that this time I knew that if I was reading The Book Thief for the audio, if I was reading that now, I'd have moments, you know, several moments, probably per chapter of embarrassment. And But I wasn't embarrassed reading Bridge of Clay. And I think this book comes with a whole lot of different sets of challenges for readers. But I hope the rewards are greater too. And I know that within me, probably maybe the best way to answer that question was that when I finished The Book Thief, it took me a few months to realise that I'd written several books before. I'd published four books before that book that really meant something to me. And that book meant everything to me. And I thought, now I only want to write books that mean everything to me every time. And I know that Bridge of Clay means everything to me and more, probably more than The Book Thief. And, you know, but it's also one of those things where you also have to say to yourself, I think we'll give this 5 years and then we'll judge how the book's gone, what its quality is like and how it's received. So, you know, so we'll see. At the moment, we're probably at the 5 minute mark. So we'll see how it looks after 5 years.
Well, you know, I think I misspoke. How many books have you written? Because
I just very rarely correct people. But, yeah, The Book Thief was my fifth book.
Oh, okay.
And Bridge of Clay is my sixth. But, you know, some people, some people think The Book Thief is my only book.
Oh.
And that's understandable as well. But I'd written three books before I Am the Messenger as well. But,
okay.
But they were definitely, you know, more in that young adult category.
Okay, well, I apologize. I was only aware of I Am the Messenger and The Book Thief, and now this one. I bought I Am the Messenger when it first came out. I was working at a bookstore, and a friend of mine, she needed a book for her son, and I said, well, I just bought this one. He can read it, but I need it back. And he is 25 years old now, and he has yet to return that book to me. I'm a little upset with that child. Anyway.
I bet that's what happens. You really do. You lend books and, you know, CDs and movies at your peril. Because even friends of ours, one of our best friends borrowed some movies from us so long ago, and she argued blue in the face that she had given them back to us, and we knew she hadn't. And then she moved house and she found them. And then she sort of, with her tail between her legs, said, oh, yeah, here are those movies. So you just can't trust people with books or movies. That's a fact.
The only books I have on my shelf are those that other people have loaned to me. No, I'm teasing. Now, do you have brothers?
Yeah, I'm the youngest of four siblings, but I have a brother and two older sisters.
I'm one of five girls, so I know nothing about brothers, but there's one place in the book when the narrator, Matthew, explained, it wasn't me, should have been printed on all of our T-shirts. It was said dozens of times each day. That just made me smile. And then also, are you experienced with piano?
Yeah, it's funny. I grew up in a household that had a lot of music in it and a lot of reading, and in the sense of my mum and dad came to Australia separately. They met in Australia, but they couldn't speak English when they arrived, and so it was really important to them for us to be good with the language, and so we had a lot of books, and I think they really wanted us to have opportunities that they didn't, and so we did have a piano, and my kids are now, they're 12 and 8 years old, and they're both, you know, forcibly made to learn the piano, and in a good way, I think. And so I've learned to play the piano more as my kids have learned, and I think that's how it ended up playing a role in this book. And just once you get onto an idea that you feel is working, you do run with it, and that's why I had Penelope learn the piano in Eastern Europe. And then for her to teach her five boys, which then, as you know, causes friction for them growing up in a neighbourhood that otherwise wouldn't be too, you know, fond of that kind of thing, you know, for five brothers growing up. So it just gave me a lot to work with. And I love the piano. And I, as my kids have learned, and I've sat with them, helping them, you know, I've learned to play as well, and I've come to really love doing it. It's pretty shoddy at times, but I have to say it's added a whole new dimension to, you know, their lives and mine.
Well, and I love the way you described it kind of as a trade-off, a trade between Penelope and her sons. I mean, they learned from her Mozart and Bach, and she learned from them this colorful language.
Yeah, it was sort of like, I think that there's that line that says it was kind of like poetry, really, but not in a very nice way.
Tell your kids not to stop with their lessons. They will regret it for the rest of their lives if they do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And actually, my 12-year-old daughter, the first 3 years of her life, she was an easy kid to discipline or be mad at because she was so unpleasant because she didn't sleep for the first 3 years of her life. And we brought that to the piano, and so she was tough, you know. And I was just able to be really tough with her, and we would always have big arguments at the piano. That we had to have that at the start of every school term. Once that was out of the way, she'd accept it and she'd really do the work. And now she doesn't need me anymore. She just goes and sits and does her, you know, all the things she has to do. And it's so nice to hear that. You know, I turn the radio off in the kitchen because I can hear her playing in the room next door, and I really love that. I love that, you know, you've got music in a household in that way. So I'm glad we've persisted, and frankly, they just don't have any other choice.
Well, there were so many parts in the book where, you know, I was brought to tears. I loved Penelope's backstory, and I loved Michael's backstory. I loved Penelope's story when she was teaching English as a second language at the school,
yeah,
and when her students would visit her when she was ill. And I just kept finding myself sobbing. So you have a heck of a book on your hands right now.
Thank you. It's funny. My kids wanted me to read bits because my wife and kids have come up to America for the first little part of this trip, because I'm not going to see them for a while. And the kids have started, you know, a few nights ago, they said, oh, come on, can you read it to us? And because I've always done that, there have been some books that we've always read aloud. So I started reading it to them. And I realize, and I can be honest to a fault at times, but I just think, you know, I realize there's work for readers to do in this book, and it just doesn't, you know, I think a lot of books now, and it's certainly not a criticism, is that, you know, books are made to be picked up and easily gotten into, and often they're not my favourite books. I look at the books that I've loved over the years and authors that I've admired, and you've got to do a bit of work for those books. And I was reading the beginning to the kids, and I was asking them, do you know what's going on here? And I worried that it would be too slow for them, or that there was too much. Because I feel like it's a book that just builds and builds and builds and builds. It doesn't give you everything at once. As I said earlier, I hope that the rewards are there. And I believe they are, but that doesn't mean everyone's going to think that. But I do hope that if you hang in there with this book, it gives you a hell of a lot. And I do think it's got a really good heart and a big heart. And I guess you can't ask for much more from yourself than that.
That was Marcus Suzak, author of Bridge of Clay, which was published by Knopf Books for Young Readers. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. You can discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Marginalia is produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.